You are not the same person as you were 10 or 20 years ago. You've changed. In a lot of cases, you might have very little in common with that person that you used to be years ago. And you're still changing, which means 10 or 20 years from now, you'll be a much different person than you are right now. And so the question is, what kind of a person are you changing into? And a big factor in answering that question is, what kind of powerful influences are you going to subject yourself to? And one of the most powerful of all influences that determines what you become is your companions, who you choose to be your companions. If you want to be wise, if you want to have a successful life, if you want to have skill in decision making, and if you want to have confidence all the time that you're right in the center of God's will, then you're going to need wisdom. And so that's why we're studying the book of Proverbs. Each one of the major themes in the book of Proverbs gives us ideas of how to be like that. And we've looked at the themes so far of righteousness, sexual sin, money, the tongue, and justice. Each one of those topics vital for understanding wisdom. This morning we come to another vitally important topic, and that's people. If you want to have a successful life, you're going to have to know how to read people. What kind of relationship to have to various kinds of people that come across your path. In chapter 2, verse 12 of Proverbs says, wisdom will save you from the ways of wicked men, from men whose words are perverse, who leave the straight paths to walk in dark ways, who delight in doing wrong and rejoice in the perverseness of evil, whose paths are crooked and who are devious in their ways. The idea is that there's these crooked, devious, dark paths that are a danger lurking out there, and the only thing that's going to rescue you from ending up on one of those paths is wisdom. So this is an issue of wisdom. The Bible has a lot to say about what you love, what your affections are toward. That's what the things that you love and hate shape your life. And that's never truer than in the area of companionship. You interact with a lot of things in life without giving much thought to how you feel about those things, but there's something about people that every single person that you interact with, you have some kind of an idea in your mind of how much you like that person. This is something we naturally do, and you gravitate towards those that you like, and whether you intend for it to happen or not, those people are going to be the ones that are going to shape what you're becoming. Chapter 13, verse 20, he who walks with the wise grows wise, but a companion of fools suffers harm. You're going to become like the people you walk with. Walk is Hebrew for hang out. Okay? Just for companionship. You may not have much influence over who it is that you work with. In some cases, you may decide to befriend wicked people for the sake of reaching them with the gospel. But the people you decide to hang around with for companionship, those are the people that influence you one way or the other. They're going to. And there are many, many people whose lives are in ruin because when they were young, they chose bad friends. And it might not be because they were attracted to the bad part of those people's lifestyle. It could be that they just hung around them because they were funny or fun to be around, or they lived nearby, or they just wanted to have some acceptance in a group, and that was the group that was available. But it doesn't matter what the reason is. The more friendship is developed with those people, the more influence they have. And not all fools are easy to spot, but there are some who are, and one of the most obvious is the ones who have a hot temper. Chapter 22, verse 24 says, do not make friends with a hot-tempered man, and do not associate with one easily angered, or you may learn his ways and get yourself ensnared. Don't get mixed up with people like that. Being around people who are angry will rub off on you. Anger is a very easy sin to fall into. It's a very contagious thing. And if you become an easily angered person, now you're a fool, and your life is going to be a mess. The angry man, the angry woman, is a person whose life is dominated by selfishness. I want certain things to happen to me in a certain way. If they don't happen the way I expect, I'm going to react. I'm mad, and I'm going to blow my stack. And once your life is driven by selfishness like that, every aspect of godliness will fall apart. So stay away. Chapter 14, verse 7, stay away from the foolish man, for you'll not find knowledge on his lips. Chapter 23, 19, do not join with those who drink too much or gorge themselves on meat, for drunkards and gluttons become poor, and drowsiness clothes them in rags. Verse 19 of that section says, listen, my son, and be wise. Keep your heart on the right path. Now, again, it's not wrong to be around unbelievers if you're around them in the way that Jesus was around them, to seek them out so that they might be saved. That's fine, but don't use that as an excuse to cover up a heart that actually enjoys the company of the world, that enjoys worldliness itself. Righteous people don't like being around the wicked. for companionship. Chapter 28, verse 4, those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but those who keep the law, that is the righteous people, resist the wicked. Chapter 28, verse 7, he who keeps the law is a discerning son, but a companion of gluttons disgraces his father. Your father is disgraced if you hang around people like that, because it becomes obvious to everybody that he's raised a fool. This is especially true when it comes to romantic relationships. So many times you hear somebody say, oh, you know, okay, yes, it's true. The guy I'm dating is an unbeliever. And yes, I understand. 2 Corinthians 6 says that we can have nothing in common and we have no fellowship and there's no harmony and there's no agreement in our relationship. And I'm supposed to come out from among them and be separate. I understand that. I'm supposed to purify myself from everything that contaminates the spirit. I understand all that. And I realize James 4:4 says that to be a friend of the world is to commit adultery against God, and friendship of the world is hatred towards God, and anyone who chooses to become a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. I understand all that. But you see, it's not that I'm attracted to anything about his lifestyle or about his spirit. It's not that I have any desire for that way of living. I just want to date him so I can reach him with the gospel. Dating evangelism. The least effective means of winning the lost ever devised. And the most cruel. And I say the most cruel because it's cruel because it's hard enough for a person already to discern when he makes a commitment to Christ whether or not that's a genuine commitment, genuine faith. And then if you come along and provide an ulterior motive and mix a lot of emotions in with the thing, then it makes it even harder for him to assess whether his faith is real. We all know the more romantic emotions you're embroiled with, the harder it is to discern your motives clearly. So suppose he is converted through your dating efforts. He's not going to be able to tell whether it's a genuine conversion. You're putting him in a disadvantage. Anytime you actually desire the companionship of the world and you rationalize it by saying, look, I'm just trying to influence them. It's going to be all that direction. They won't have any influence on me. Remember Proverbs 25:26, like a muddied spring or a polluted well is a righteous man who gives way to the wicked. It's a tragic thing. There are also other motives people have for getting involved with unbelieving friends, wicked friends, besides romantic attraction. Sometimes it's out of a desire just to be around those sinful activities. The person wants sin, he wants the sin, but he knows he can't do it, and so he just sort of enjoys the sin vicariously by hanging around people that do that. You know, you wish you could enjoy what they enjoy. You wish you could have the fun that they seem to be having. Proverbs 24:1, do not envy the wicked men. Don't envy them. Do not desire their company. Sometimes people just get mixed up in a bad crowd because they want to be accepted by that group. That's the whole deal with gangs, right? Street gangs, very often. I've seen videos of people being initiated into a street gang, and the initiation process is to allow yourself to be beaten to a pulp by the gang without defending yourself. They just stand there and then lay there and get kicked and beaten, and that gives you an idea how badly some of those kids want to be in those gangs. That the desire to be in a community, to be accepted into a community, and to have status in that community. Very powerful desire. That's always been the case. You know, there's always been problems with gang violence. There were in Solomon's day. Right in chapter 1 of Proverbs, starts right out in verse 10, says, my son, this is talking about a gang here. If sinners entice you, do not get into them. If they say, come along with us, let's lie and wait for someone's blood. Let's waylay some harmless soul. Let's swallow them alive like a grave and whole like those who go down to the pit. We'll get all sorts of valuable things and fill our houses with plunder and throw your lot in with us and we'll share in a common purse. The appeal is the violence itself. Come with us. We can do violence and we can make a lot of money. My son, do not go along with them. Do not set foot on their paths, for their feet rush into sin. They're swift to shed blood. How useless to spread a net in full view of the birds. These men lie in wait for their own blood, waylay only themselves, such is the end of all who go after ill-gotten gain. It takes the lives of those who get it. People in the gang generally will come to an early violent death. Now, I threw that in because it's a theme in Proverbs. Most of you probably aren't tempted by membership in street gangs. I understand that. But there are some other gangs that do have more of appeal for common people. We all have that same longing to belong to a community and to have status in the community. And very often something happens in the church that offends a person. You get mad, somebody treats you the wrong way, sins against you, you get mad, you leave the church. And very often when people do that, they're disaffected with the church, they're disillusioned, and then along comes some cult that shows that person lots of attention and lots of care and kindness and generosity. And he feels like he's getting all the things that he didn't get at the church. and he becomes willing to join that spiritual gang. Those are the worst kinds of gangs. They do more harm than the street gangs do. So stay away. Bad friends will harm you. They'll bring all kinds of different kinds of harm, and Proverbs just catalogs a bunch of different ways in which bad friends will cause you harm. For one thing, they won't keep secrets. They'll betray you. They're not trustworthy. Chapter 20, verse 19, a gossip betrays confidence, so avoid a man who talks too much. You'll share something with them and they'll blab it all over the place. You won't be able to trust your friend. Another thing, if you have people like that as companions, you'll find yourself in a lot of arguments all the time and fights. You'll always be fighting with your friends. Chapter 22, verse 10, drive out the mocker and outgoes strife and quarrels and insults are ended. They may show you kindness, but very often they have an ulterior motive for that. And the things that they do give you, you end up paying for it. Chapter 23, verse 6, interesting passage, says, do not eat the food of a stingy man. Do not crave his delicacies, for he's the kind of man who's always thinking about the cost. Eat and drink, he says to you, but his heart is not with you. And you'll vomit up the little you've eaten, and you'll have wasted your compliments. What happens is they keep track of the good things that they give you. They keep track, they hold that over your head for the future, and you'll regret ever accepting those gifts from them, because you'll end up having to pay. Another thing, not only all that, but you get in trouble by being around them just because of the judgment they receive from God. Chapter 24, verse 21, fear Yahweh and the king, my son, and do not join with the rebellious, for those two, the Lord and the king, will send suddenly destruction upon them, and who knows what calamities they can bring. Hanging around the wicked invites trouble just because of the splash effect of the judgment they get from the government and from God. And in some cases, that judgment might be deserved when it hits you, because just by being their friends, in some cases, you can serve as being an accomplice towards the wicked things that they're doing. Chapter 29, verse 24, the accomplice of the thief is his own enemy, and he's put under oath, and he dare not testify. You can enable them and yourself be guilty. And as good a friend as they might seem to be, they seem very kind, and they seem like they really like you, and they're really loyal to you. But when you need them the most, they won't be there. Chapter 25, verse 19, like a bad tooth or a lame foot is reliance on the unfaithful in times of trouble. It's foolish to rely on unfaithful men, and that's what you're doing when you select bad companions. You know, we teach our kids to pursue good friendships and not to hang around bad influences, and that's good. We should teach our kids that. It's very, very important. But you might be sitting there in the pew thinking, okay, this sounds like this could be, you know, for a youth talk. I'm not in junior high anymore. It's not like I'm tempted to run around with, you know, join a gang or criminals or something like that. But let's not oversimplify the concept. I want you to think this through. There are many, many adults in the church, I believe, who need to hear this message, because you may not be tempted to spend your time with a bunch of drug addicts and criminals or whatever, but a lot of people in church find themselves hanging around the kinds of people who will never challenge them. You find some nice, upstanding, friendly people in the church whose spiritual lives are kind of tepid and mediocre. They don't entice you to do any evil, but they don't talk about righteousness much either. They're safe. The things they talk about are funny. They're enjoyable to be around. They have great, you know, they're great conversationalists. But they don't make any demands on your life. They never make any demands, and they never tighten any screws on you to cause you to aspire towards a higher level of commitment to Christ or to work on some area of sin in your life. They have all the same weaknesses that you have, and being around them makes you feel a lot better about the fact that you hardly ever crack open your Bible during the week, or you don't feel so bad about your prayerlessness or the coolness of your love towards God, because they're the same way. It's not enough just to avoid blatantly evil people. You know, I mentioned last week at Sunday Night Prayer that I was going to preach on companionship this week, and as soon as I said that, Kay spoke up and said, you know what, I can summarize your whole sermon right now in one sentence. If you don't want fleas, stay away from the dogs. That's pretty good. But it actually only summarizes the first half of the sermon. Because there's also a positive side. The message of Proverbs is not just stay away from bad influences, but there's a stronger emphasis even on seeking out good influences. Chapter 13, verse 20, he who walks with the wise grows wise, but a companion of fools suffers. That is an amazing proverb. You realize what that's saying? It doesn't say you have to be formally discipled by them. It doesn't say you have to be taught by them even. It just says, walk with them. You know, people break their backs to get wisdom. People will shell out hundreds, thousands of dollars for classes and books and tapes and videos and seminars and therapists. And they do all that in the pursuit of wisdom because they know how valuable wisdom is and they feel like they've got to have it. They've got to find out what is the wise thing to do. And it amazes me that people will do all that and not seek out wisdom from the greatest treasure of wisdom in any one place. The church. It amazes me when we examine people for leadership and we find somebody to be qualified under the character qualifications of 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, and that's determined by the whole church. It amazes me that more people don't just flock around those people just because they want to be around them, because they want to walk with the wise. Everything else in life comes with a price tag all the time. People pay thousands for a counselor whose character they don't even know. And yet these people will pour themselves out to you for free. You need wisdom, you need counseling for anything. You need help in your marriage, you need help in your life, you need to get something straightened out. I know where you can get some top-flight counseling. I know a place where you can go and get counseling from a whole group of top-flight counselors who will not only give you counsel, but who really will devote themselves to you and pray for you and commit themselves to you. And you can have a session once a week for free. Just come on Saturday mornings. Plus you get breakfast to boot. That's if you're a man. That's a men's group. There are women's groups too. But do what Proverbs 13:20 says and become wise by walking with the wise. And that word walk really gives you an idea of how important the friendship part of it is. We always want to have sessions with a counselor. You know, we meet with someone once a week. But that doesn't, it doesn't say consult with the wise. It says you'll grow wise by walking with the wise. Being their companion. Before I came here, each church I went to, I always made it my goal to try and find a way to be around the wise men in the church. That's more valuable to me than any scholarship at Bible school or anything else. Just to be around and watch how they live. You know, I've learned a lot from just direct counsel from wise men, like from my dad, you know, or from Joe. I'll ask questions, and they give me direct answers. It's very helpful. But I've learned a lot more just by being around them, just watching them, watching what they do in certain circumstances and so on. Proverbs has so much to say about the importance of godly friendships. Chapter 27, verse 17, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. I love that one because it illustrates the fact that you don't have to really be superior to anybody to help them. You don't have to be advanced beyond them spiritually. We tend to think, you know, if I got a big problem, I got to see a pastor, a professional counselor, or someone a lot older and so on. But a person doesn't have to be that advanced. All they have to do is be a piece of iron. That's all. I mean, if you're just a rough piece of iron, that's all I need to help scrape off the rough edges that I've got, because that's all I am, is a big, rough block of iron. So seek out good friendships and develop those friendships beyond the superficial level. Depth. Chapter 17, verse 17. Listen to this proverb. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. You grasp the value of that? You understand how incredibly valuable friends like that are? You know how important it is to have someone in your life who will love you at all times? A godly friend is like that. He'll give you the love when you need love the most, and no one else will. When you come to him in times of trouble in your life, times of adversity and sorrow and pain, those times when other people are just tired of being around you because you're a drain, because you're going through so much, a godly friend will say, I was born for this. Come over to my house. This is why I'm here on this planet, is to be there for you when you're in this kind of desperate need. If you're wise, you'll make it very high on your priority list to acquire friends like that. So often, there are people who wait until they're in desperate need of a friend like that. And they don't do anything to invest themselves to develop friendships at all. They just sort of stand aloof, and then they wait until they're in desperate need, and then they look around and say, why isn't anybody befriending me? Why isn't anybody here for me? There's a certain amount of love and care that you should receive from all Christians just because they're Christians. But there's a certain kind of depth of love that you need from a close, close friend that really, really knows you that just has to be developed. So do what it takes. Do whatever it takes to get friends like this. You have to sacrifice some family time, do it. Because friends like that will end up benefiting your family in the long run anyway. If you have to work a little less and make a little less money, do it. Friends like this are worth more than money. If you have to sacrifice a little sleep or some recreation, or if it costs you money, or if it costs you a lot of emotional time and expenditure, Do what it takes to develop these kind of godly friendships. Pay the price. It's worth it. If you're wise, you'll do it. In the world, most people don't even have a chance at finding, even if they're willing to pay the price, they're not able to find friends like this. But you do. In this place, you know, in the leadership training meeting recently, one of the people, we were going through the character qualifications, and I mentioned to the man, I said, look, these are just relative. You don't have to be perfect in every one of these. You just have to be, relative to the church, you have to be the kind of person that's exemplary so that people can follow your example. You know, the people of the church. And the answer that came back from a couple of the guys is, why does it have to be Creekside Church? I mean, you know, there are some places where it's not too hard to rise to the level of being an example for everybody, but you're a remarkable bunch. And it takes quite a man or quite a woman to stand as a character example for all of you. And all that to say, this is an amazing place. You have what a crop of potential friends you have here. Whatever you think of our worship style or the preaching style, a seating arrangement or whatever else, one thing's for sure, this is a place where you can walk with the wise. In the coming weeks, we're going to be launching several new small groups, and I strongly urge every single one of you to give serious consideration to finding at least one that you can really give yourself to. And make it a non-negotiable commitment to commit to that for 10 weeks. Even if you have all the friends you need already, still do it, because there's someone who needs you as a friend. I mean, if you've so much as skimmed the New Testament, you know there is no way that you can fulfill the one another commands of the New Testament here on Sunday morning. You can't do it. It's too big of a group. It's impossible. If you've forgotten that, listen back, get tape 152, that tape on love one another deeply from the heart. Remember that when we started the Sunday morning thing? Listen to that tape again and you'll realize there's so much required of us that you cannot accomplish here on Sunday morning. Recently someone asked me if he knew of any good counselors I could refer him to, and I said, yeah, a whole church full. And I said, why don't you come to the men's group and share your struggles with them? And listen to part of this response. He sent me this response in a letter, and he said there'd be pros and cons to doing that. And he listed the pros, and that was great. And then he said this. Here's the cons. Listen to this. My questions really hurt. It's painful to be honest with myself and with God. I can hardly journal and pray without shedding tears, much less open up before others, especially to a group of people I don't even know very well. It would hurt to bring up stuff with the group and then have the people respond judgmentally, self-righteously, or, get this, casually. If I brought this up with a group, I would be looking to see if others, in fact, do care. And so I'll ask you, is such as sharing really the purpose of this kind of group? Will others really, in quote, invest their lives getting to know me? That's what I promised him. And are others really concerned about, quote, helping each other with our weaknesses? If that is, in fact, what the group is all about, I may take the risk of sharing with the group. I would like to be part of a group with such a purpose, but since I have never seen a group fulfill this purpose in any depth, I'm skeptical as to whether or not we have such a group. There's part of me that would like to share, but there's part that is scared to do so. There's a difference between being popular and establishing real friendships. Some of you love to have lots of friends, and what it does is it spreads you so thin that you can't have any real depth with any of them. But those of us who are not oriented towards a lot of social interaction as much have only one or two friends, but we develop those friends a lot deeper. Whatever your personality type, push yourself to developing at least one real, deep, strong friendship. Because having a lot of companions doesn't do you much good in times of trouble. Those companions, when you come to a point of really being in desperate need of a friend, will not tend to not have much time for you. They might flock around you at parties, social events. You might feel real popular. When the time comes, though, that you need a real friend, they're busy. So don't strive to be popular. Strive to be one of those kinds of friends that will stick closer than a brother. People like that really do end up being closer than family. Chapter 27, verse 10 talks about that. You're better off to go to one of those kind of friends than a relative. It's not easy to build those kind of friendships. It takes work, and it's risky. It requires opening yourself up to people, allowing that person the ability to really hurt you, and sometimes they will. That's why these kind of friendships are so rare. Chapter 20, verse 6 talks about how rare they are. It says, many a man claims to have unfailing love, but a faithful man who can find? Who can find a faithful man? And all the single women in the church said, amen. Did I hear a couple of you married ladies join in that amen? I don't know. It's tough to find this kind of friend. You can't just spot them across the room. You don't know who they're going to be. You never know. You know, when we went to Oklahoma Tracy at that time was really in desperate need of a friend. All her close friends from the previous church just turned on her overnight when I got fired, and people she thought were close friends. She was incredibly lonely and hurt and wounded and desperately needed a good friend. And so in Oklahoma, we started hanging around, all the couples our age, and we were trying to develop friendships. And you know, we enjoyed those people's company, and we hit it off okay, but it didn't really click between Tracy and any of those ladies and into any real close friendship. But it turned out there was someone in the church that she ended up being very, very close with, her best friend out there. It turned out to be a great friend, and it was the person that she never would have occurred to her that that might be the person. It was a woman in her late 70s who didn't really stick out as being anything different than anyone else at first, but they just clicked and hit it off and was a great, great friend. You usually won't be able to find friends. The point is, you can't look around and just find, oh, that would make a perfect friend. I think I'll be a friend with that. I mean, you just can't predict it. Like Adam, the whole time he was looking, all he could find was animals. Then he goes to sleep, and there she was. The only way to do it, the only way to find friends like this is just to be this kind of friend to everybody. And you'll tend to attract these kind of people, which means you're going to be a friend to some people that aren't necessarily, you're not all that attracted to at first. But if you're willing to put forth the time and effort to being that kind of friend to others, then if you're not willing to do that, then you're going to miss the chances for the deep friendships that really would profit you. And the most important decision that you'll ever make regarding companionship, of course, is who you're going to marry. And there are a number of Proverbs, very many, that talk about the headaches that come from having a bad spouse, especially a bad wife. Chapter 11, 22, like a gold ring and a pig's snout is a beautiful woman who shows no discretion. Chapter 12, verse 4, a disgraceful wife is like decay in her husband's bones. Chapter 21, verse 9, better to live in the corner of a roof than to share a house with a quarrelsome wife. Better to live in the desert than a quarrelsome, ill-tempered wife. The quarrelsome wife is like a constant dripping on a rainy day. Restraining her is like grasping the oil with the hand. The foolish woman tears her house down. A foolish son is his father's ruin. A quarrelsome wife is like a constant dripping. I mean, it goes on and on. And some of you are thinking, why so many about a bad wife? Where are the proverbs about a bad husband? Actually, I can think of one. Chapter 30 lists four things that ought never to happen. And number three is an unloved woman who is married. Chapter 30, verse 23. It's an absolutely intolerable situation when a woman is married and not loved by her husband. That's a terrible thing. But other than that, I don't know of any. And I think my guess for the reason for that is this. In that culture, the women, I don't think, had much say in who they married. The men were making mostly that decision. So women didn't really need wisdom on how to select a mate because they weren't selecting mates. It wasn't up to them. So the advice is given to men because men were deciding who they were going to marry. But in a culture like ours, where women have just as much input into selecting a mate as a man does, this counsel applies. So I think women should just take all these same proverbs and fill in the word spouse and apply the same kinds of principles when they're selecting a mate. And the point is really very simple. Don't pick a bad spouse. Instead, pick a good spouse. Now, obviously, nobody intends to pick a bad spouse. And yet, lots of people end up with bad spouses, don't they? And the reason for that is because people ignore the most important principle Proverbs teaches on selecting a good spouse, and that is, very simple, pick one with noble character. When people are thinking about getting married, they take a million things into consideration. They consider the finances and the job situation, what do we have in common, and what do we like to do together, and how strong are my romantic feelings, and how do I feel about this person, what kind of attraction is there, and does she want to have kids, and what are his parents like, and all these questions. But the message of Proverbs is that the overriding principle is the person righteous, and do they have noble character, and that's the issue, and that's what matters. Those other things you can live with. You know, I've done a lot of marriage counseling, and Maybe someday, somebody will come into my office with a marital problem that doesn't at its root have the problem of spiritual immaturity or ungodliness as a cause. Maybe that'll happen someday, but it hasn't happened yet. People are not miserable in their marriages because of not having enough in common or somebody not looking a certain way or anything like that. People are miserable in their marriages because living in the same house with an ungodly or spiritually immature person is almost unbearable, especially if you're also a spiritually immature person. So above all, discern the person's level of godliness, which is hard to do when there are a lot of emotions. Obviously, the more you're in love, the person seems great. But then after the wedding, things go south. So how can you avoid that? Well, one thing you could do is let the church help. I really believe in this. In our leadership evaluation process, we're actually getting pretty good at discerning people's character. So we could help you with that. Proverbs offers a couple things to watch for. One is wisdom. I read you that 11:22. Like a gold ring and a pig's snout is a beautiful woman who shows no discretion. That is an amazing proverb. Don't let physical attractiveness blind you. Gold rings, when they're in a pig's snout, really lose their appeal in a hurry, their visual appeal. Physical attractiveness is not important. It's not what's going to make you happy in marriage. What will? Discretion, it says. A woman who shows discretion, discernment, wisdom. Another big issue is temper. Several of those proverbs talk about the fact that you're better off alone in the corner somewhere than with a quarrelsome wife. You may be head over heels in love with someone and you might think, well, yeah, you know, she argues a lot, but that, nobody's perfect. I can live with that. It's true, nobody's perfect, but not everybody is argumentative or ill-tempered or easily angered. And a woman who is not ready for marriage. And a man who's easily angered is not ready for marriage. Chapter 15, verse 16, better a little with the fear of the Lord than great wealth with turmoil. That's another principle. You shouldn't get married until, I mean, it's okay to wait until he's in a position to support a family, but you don't have to be rich. You'd be a lot happier scraping together on $25,000 a year with a godly man than to have six figures and just be in fights all the time. In fact, verse 17 says, better a meal of vegetables where there is love than fatted calf with hatred. Imagine that. Vegetables? This proverb cracks me up. Evidently, Solomon didn't care for green beans or something. I don't know. How do you know when it would be a good idea to get married? Well, when you find somebody with noble character, then it's time to get married. Chapter 12, verse 4. A wife of noble character is her husband's crown, but a disgraceful wife is like decay in his bones. Maybe you aren't smitten with emotions for the person, and maybe you wish there were somebody, you know, there were more of a physical attraction between the two of you. Maybe you have those things like that you desire. Those things aren't important. Those aren't the things that are going to bring real joy in marriage, no matter who you marry. And no matter how she looks. She's not going to look like that when she's at her ugliest, which is when you're going to be seeing her. Which is why all the perfect Hollywood beauties keep divorcing each other. No matter who you marry, it's a lifelong process, really, of learning to truly love that person. And to truly be attracted to that person. And that can be done with anyone. What's really important is godliness, especially humility and selflessness. That's what you need to find. And don't throw up your hands and say, well, you know, finding a good spouse is so hard, forget it, it's impossible. It's hard, but it's worth the effort. Chapter 18, verse 22, he who finds a wife finds what is good and receives favor from Yahweh. Chapter 19, verse 14, houses and wealth are inherited from parents, but a prudent wife is from Yahweh. And the greatest statement, of course, on the value of a noble wife is in chapter 31. In fact, turn to Proverbs 31. The Proverbs 31 woman. Beautiful passage. It's an alphabetic acrostic in the Hebrew. It means each verse starts the next Hebrew letter in the alphabet. I think this passage has intimidated more women than it's encouraged, frankly. I know there are some women who find this their least favorite passage in the Bible. I think there are some women who think that if it just weren't for that getting up before dawn verse, I could be the Proverbs 31 woman. One thing to keep in mind is that Proverbs 31 was not primarily written for women. It's not intended as a checklist for women to try and do all those things. It's written to men. And what it's saying is, men, you find a noble woman and she'll end up being like this. That's how valuable she is. The whole point is about value, her value. That's the essential point. It's not that when you're ready to get married, you should go out there and try and find a woman that's already like this. That's not the point. The point is you should try and find a virtuous woman, because if you find a virtuous woman, she'll end up doing things like this. It's all about her value, and it's so easy to summarize this section. All you have to do is say a godly woman is of immense value. So if you're a woman of noble character, this chapter, if it properly interpreted, should be a huge encouragement. The poem begins in verse 10 with a statement, explicit statement of the premise. A wife of noble character, who can find? The idea is women like this are rare. The point, and that's not to say, you know, good luck finding one, guys. You'll probably never find this, you know. That's not the point. It's to highlight her value. Rare in the sense of precious. Because just look at the parallel statement in the rest of the verse. Wife of noble character, who can find? She's worth far more than rubies. So in that parallelism, the second line is saying the same thing as the first line in a slightly different way. So the point is, if you have a wife of noble character, you have a real treasure. Literally, you have a treasure. The basis of wisdom is knowing which things are more valuable than other things in life. Remember that? And you should know that a wife of noble character is way up there on the scale of what's important. The only other thing in this book that is compared to rubies, that is said to be more valuable than rubies, is wisdom itself. Chapter 3, chapter 8, and chapter 20. You say, a noble wife is as valuable as wisdom itself? Yeah. In fact, most scholars regard this section, this noble wife section, as a summary of the whole book of Proverbs. It closes out the book. You know, this woman is a personification of wisdom. You get done reading over these hundreds of Proverbs all the way through the whole book, and you're left at the end trying to get your arms around all this wisdom. And so the book ends up with a picture that summarizes what the whole book has taught us and puts it all in one package that we can picture. A godly woman. So she's valuable. That's the point. You say, what makes her so valuable? What's so valuable about a woman like this? Well, verse 11. Her husband has full confidence in her and lacks nothing. One thing about her that's so valuable is she brings benefits to her husband. He can trust her to run the house. He doesn't have to keep an eye on her. He can leave her with the checkbook without having to worry. He can count on her to take good care of the home. He might not have an expensive house or a nice car or things like that, but he doesn't lack anything of real value if he's got her. She's the only asset that he really needs, humanly speaking. Verse 12, she brings him good, not harm, all the days of her life. Chapter 20, or verse 23, her husband is respected in the city gate where he takes his seat among the elders of the land. He's respected because of her is the implication. And that's interesting. It's interesting that there's no mention of her having any kind of a status because of her husband. He's a big shot in the city gate. He's sitting in the council there. And it doesn't say anything about her having any importance as a result of being married to him. It never says that she's well respected because of who she's married to. A lot of women sometimes gain their sense of importance from their husbands. But this woman is praised not for who she's married to, but because of her noble character. And her husband is respected because he's married to her. So she brings benefits to the family, and then to the husband, and she also brings benefits to the family. Look at verse 13. She selects wool and flax and works with eager hands, and she's like the merchant ships, bringing her food from afar. Some people misread that. She's not on the merchant ship. She's like the ship in that she brings goods. She keeps bringing goods. You know what this is talking about? Shopping. That's right. Can you hear another amen there? One of the most wonderful things about the Proverbs 31 woman is that she goes shopping. She goes out and comes back with all the things the family needs. She's a source of wonderful things for the house. Verse 15, she gets up. See, you like this chapter more than you thought, don't you, ladies? Verse 15, she gets up while it's still dark. Here's this verse. She provides food for her family and portions for her servant girls. That's what it's like to have a godly wife while your neighbor who married the supermodel down the street is eating cornflakes because his wife stacked out till 10 o'clock in the morning, every morning. Your wife is up with the family and taking care of people, and she's not the last one up all the time. The picture here is of a wealthy woman. I mean, this is a kind of an aristocratic woman here in this analogy. She has servant girls and all that, and yet she's up making breakfast. I don't think this passage is saying that to be of noble character, you have to get less sleep than you need. You need 8 hours of sleep, you need 8 hours of sleep, you ought to sleep 8 hours. But it does say something about diligence. She's not lazy. She sets her schedule around the needs of the family. That's the kind of thing noble women do. Verse 16, she considers a field and buys it, and out of her earnings she plants a vineyard. Verse 24, she makes linen garments and sells them and supplies merchants with sashes. She's doing all this stuff. You say, wait a minute, does that mean a godly wife has to bring in an income? No. Are we supposed to picture a woman here who in her spare time, between weaving all of her family's clothes, is successful in real estate, farming, sales, and textiles? No. It's just saying that a godly wife is valuable because she tends to be intelligent and make wise use of resources, and she makes wise decisions. She's industrious. That's what it's saying. No woman could do all those things, have all those careers. Some people have pointed to this and say, that's why a woman should have a career. Well, if you're going to say that, she has to have four careers simultaneously. No woman could do that, and no woman should try. The point is just that these are the kinds of things that godly women tend to do. No woman does all of them. Verse 17, she sets about her work vigorously. Her arms are strong for her tasks. She's diligent. She works hard. Verse 18, she sees her trading is profitable, and her lamp does not go out at night. Noble women, when they need to, will stay up late getting things done. Maybe she's up with the baby all through the night, and then during the day, somehow she manages to get work done during the day after being up all night. Her job goes around the clock. You know, you go to work for 8 hours or 10 hours or something, you come home exhausted, you need to rest from 6 o'clock until it's time to go to bed, and you sleep all night. In the meantime, your wife, especially if there's young children, she's going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, caring for little children, no rest, ever. She can't so much as go to the bathroom without someone coming and banging on the door and wanting something. It's a task so relentless that it's only by God's grace, it seems to me, that it doesn't push a woman into insanity. No rest, no breaks. Some of the women aren't hearing this because they're off nursing their babies right now. Verse 19, in her hands she holds the distaff and grasps the spindle with her fingers. Those are just common household tasks in ancient times. You can get the principle by just filling in the common household tasks of our day. She's doing loads of laundry. She's emptying the dishwasher. She's sweeping the floor. She's off to Walmart getting some stuff. She's taking the kids, getting the kids' shoes. She's running errands. Verse 21, when it snows, she has no fear of her household, for all of them are clothed in scarlet. She makes coverings for her bed. She's clothed in fine linen and purple. Purple is the most expensive color of fabric because it came from a very expensive, expensive process to make it. If the Proverbs 31 woman were married to someone like me, she would also have to put up with complaints about when she got home. Why always the fine purple? Don't you know for a quarter what you paid for that? You could get the brown polyester stuff. Women like this like to get nice things for their family. Verse 27, she watches over the affairs of her household. In our house, it occurred to me when I was studying this, all our kids have jackets. They all have mittens. They all have gloves. They have socks. And it's not because I got them any of those things. Tracy makes sure everybody has everything they need. She knows who in the house just doesn't have enough shirts, or their pants have holes in them or whatever. Verse 27, she doesn't eat the bread of idleness. It's kind of a tricky phrase. Perhaps eating the bread of idleness means eating food that you don't deserve to eat because you're idle. If you're idle, if you're not working, you don't deserve. You shouldn't get any bread. This woman's not like that. She manages the whole amazing operation of the home, which is nothing like managing a business, because the home can only be managed by love and incredible self-sacrifice. Verse 28, her children arise and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women do noble things, but you surpass them all. And by the way, if you're trying to be like the Proverbs 31 woman, keep that phrase in mind. This description is intended to surpass all of the women in the world, including you. So that's what it's a picture of all the nobility of women. Verse 25, she's clothed with strength and dignity. She can laugh at the days to come. She's not worried and distressed about the future. She has a joyful, optimistic outlook because she's thought ahead, planned ahead. She's not caught off guard by the troubles of tomorrow. You're sitting there thinking, wow, how could you find a woman like that? Simple, just find a virtuous woman. That's how they end up turning out. So what virtues are listed in this chapter? Not that many, really. Verse 20, she opens her arms to the poor and extends her hands to the needy. She's generous. Verse 26, she speaks with wisdom and faithful instruction on her tongue. And verse 30 sums it up by saying she fears the Lord. She's generous, she's kind, she's wise, and above all, she fears God. That's all. You find a woman who's generous, kind, wise, and fears God, marry her, and you're in for this whole thing. That's what she'll end up being more and more like. Now, should this be intimidating to women? Are there women here? Are there any women here who fear the Lord and who are generous and kind and wise? Sure. Those are Proverbs 31 women. And sooner or later, they're going to start doing more and more of the kinds of things listed in this chapter. People always act like no woman measures up to the standard. I disagree with that. I think there's a whole lot of noble women in this very room right now. Isn't that true? Don't we have women who are kind and generous and wise, fear the Lord? Isn't it true that those women who are like that tend to do things like this? Aren't those women doing things like causing people to respect her husband, going out in the minivan and coming back with all kinds of wonderful things for the home? Sometimes a few extras. Going to the market, getting supplies to the house all the time, bringing home soap and toilet paper and pillowcases and food and whatever. Staying up late sometimes, getting up early sometimes to care for the family, making shrewd use of the resources and the family, preparing for the future, caring for the children, supplying the household, managing the household. Aren't the women here doing that? I think so. I know of two women for sure, my wife and my mom, that are like that. In fact, that list didn't even scratch the surface of the things that they do. I'd like to see this Proverbs 31 woman do all this and do half the ministries that Tracy does at Creekside. And Tracy doesn't even have servant girls. You marry someone like that, you've required... You marry a godly woman, you've acquired a priceless treasure. You say, what about, body shape? And I've got high standards. I want someone who's gorgeous. I want someone I can't take my eyes off. Or I want someone with an ideal figure, beautiful hair, perfect, whatever. Surely it's not wrong for me to desire to marry a beautiful woman, right? Or women will say the same thing. I want to be swept off my feet. I know this guy I'm dating now. He's a great spiritual leader. He's godly. But he's not Prince Charming. I want someone who gives me the shivers every time I think about him. And I just, look at verse 30. Charm is deceptive. And beauty is fleeting. Temporary. But a woman who fears Yahweh is to be praised. Those kinds of things aren't wrong to desire at some level, but they shouldn't be the priority because they're temporary. No matter what she looks like, it doesn't take long to get over the initial excitement of that, get used to that. There are men who have had the opportunity to marry women of noble character and passed it up because she wasn't attractive to him physically. Men like that are idiots. Worse than idiots, they're fools. I realize most of you men are already married, so what's in this message for you? Verse 31 is for you. Give her. This is the first command. Give her the reward she has earned, and let her works bring her praise at the city gate. The very last statement in the whole book of Proverbs is a command to give your wife the reward that she's earned. It's so easy to fall into thinking, oh, you know, this is her job. Yeah, her job is hard. I understand her job is hard, but that's her lot in life. That's what God called her to. That's what she signed on for when she became a wife and a mother. And we just take her work for granted, but noble women are to receive a reward for being like that. Let's be wise about our companions that we choose. Don't be attracted to the world. Don't choose worldly people as companions. Make an effort to walk with the wise. Invest yourself in building deep, close friendships. And those of you who are single, set your priorities right on selecting a mate. Father, we thank you for this practical wisdom. And we thank you just for companionship in general, just the fact that you've given us companionship, that we're not lonely, that we're not doomed to loneliness as people in the church, even though some of us, Lord, some in this room, have had to give up family in order to follow you and have had family taken away from them for various reasons. That you've promised that when a person immerses himself or herself into your church, that they'll have 100 times as much family in this life, mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and daughters and sons. I pray that we might be faithful family to those who need us as family. We might pour ourselves into your church. We pray this in your holy name. Amen.